Good morning to everybody and dear friends, of course both genders. I'm really happy to be here and to open the fifth section of this Oxford Girona Genoa seminar. In fact, I think it is becoming a success. We are going to think to make it even more successful, but we'll see later on. Now, I want to introduce you Dr. Frederick Wilmot Smith from Oxford University, who will talk to us about legality, ought, and can. He has 30 minutes, more or less. Well, okay. Thank you very much. More or less. Take your time.
Yeah? Okay. Bueno, muchas gracias por invitarme. Es un placer estar aquí. Entonces, gracias y a Esteban por organizar todo para mí. Thank you. It really is a pleasure to be here. I'm delighted to be in Girona and to speak to you all. So thank you. The only thing I don't want to thank people for is having me speak first. I was also not told that there was going to be a recording of this. So in many ways, I'm feeling overwhelmed by the turn of events this morning. What I'm going to try and do in this talk is to say something about the topic in general that I'm thinking about in this paper, how I came to look at it, because the paper itself is one part of a two-part series, and you haven't had the other part, so I think it would be helpful if I say something about the project in general and how this paper fits in with that. I'm then aware that a number of people haven't had the paper, and so I'm going to spend a bit longer than I normally would saying what I say in it. And then I will say what I anyway find difficult with it or what I'm struggling with at the moment, so you can tell me whether you agree or whether you think there are even bigger problems than that in it, in the Q&A. I got interested in ought implies can and its relation to the law because it kept cropping up in things that I read. People would make references to it. But there was, as far as I could see, and I've since discovered I think this is true, there was no systematic attempt to relate these things or to work out what the relation was between ought implies can and the law. And my aim was initially to just clarify that relation. This paper is sort of a product of the initial project where I was attempting to do that for reasons that I hope will become clear when I explain something more about the initial paper. The maxim itself, ought implies can, is usually attributed to Kant in the literature. That's actually an open question whether that's an appropriate attribution, but I'm going to try in these remarks to prescind from the scholastic debate on the maxim itself and just to think more generally about the maxim as a sort of intuitive measure. I mean, intuitively, the thought is something like, if ought implies can, people assume that it runs in contraposition, and so they say, if it's not the case that you're able to do something, it's not the case that you ought to do it. And then an example would be, is it the case that I ought to stop war in the Middle East? Well, it so happens that I'm incapable of doing that, so it's not the case that I ought to do it. And various things are sometimes seen as falling out of that, sometimes seen as different maxims, like I can't be blamed for things I'm unable to avoid, things of that nature. The way it often comes up in law is that people refer to token norms or standards and say, because they violate ought implies can in some respect, that they're problematic in some way. The way I first saw this, I think, was in the tort law literature, and it was an objection to the objective standard of care. So the thought was, in a situation where an individual is required to be reasonable, and reasonable is held to an objective standard, then that can go beyond the factual grasp of the agent. It may be that the agent themselves is unable to meet the objective or reasonableness standard. And people sometimes seem to think that this is a problem, or at least something worth addressing. And that has been at times expressed, or the objection has been expressed in the language of ought implies can. So it was examples like that that got me onto thinking about this. Now, in the first paper I wrote, then I spend almost all of my time saying why that's a bad way of looking at the problem. I mean, the whole structure of that paper is to say that it's a much more complicated argument than it seems to be supposed when people are writing about ought implies can. It's a much more complicated argument to take the maxim and then say something about the law than seems to be supposed. And one way of seeing why that's the case, or why I think that's the case, is that the maxim is usually taken to be a conceptual claim about oughts. The thought isn't that it's sort of unfair to hold someone responsible for some action when they were unable to avoid it. The thought's instead, it's a conceptual mistake to say someone ought to do something when they're incapable of doing it. But that kind of argument doesn't really work in law. I mean, you can't attribute a conceptual mistake to the law in that respect because, well, it just is the case that the law is making these demands of you. And usually people want to say, and that's unfair. And it doesn't make any sense to say it's conceptually confused to attribute this responsibility to someone, and it's unfair, because it can be one or the other, it can't be both. If it was conceptually confused to attribute the responsibility to them, then it's not unfair because there's no responsibility in the first place that you're trying to object to. So there's an immediate asymmetry between the way lawyers want to use the maxim, i.e. to make some kind of claim that we should change the law, that the demands of the law are too exacting, and the way in which it's used in the moral philosophy literature. That means, to cut a longer paper short, that I think it's an unprofitable move to rely upon ought implies can when criticizing the law. It's rarely useful to make conceptual objections to claims about legal responsibility in that respect. Something like that is the thought of the first paper. Now, the problem with that is that it's an entirely negative paper. It's just saying all of these people have talked about the maxim, and they're all wrong to do so. That's not a very helpful thing to say, because clearly a lot of these people have they've got reasons for wanting to rely upon it, and they're not crazy, I think, for thinking that there's some kind of objection in this domain which is worth taking seriously. And so one of the points of this paper is to try and see what sense there is, or what can we get out of talking about ought implies can in this context. Now, I think that I mostly, in this paper, vindicate the kind of arguments that people want to make, but I separate them from ought implies can as a whole. So they're not beholden to that literature, the kind of arguments that I'm saying people can make about law. They're not beholden to the soundness of ought implies can, to the validity of running the contraposition, and all of these sort of technical debates that there are within the moral philosophy literature. So in a sense, I think this is a good thing. It means that we lawyers can escape from the moral philosophy debates there. But that's the explanation for why I'm dealing with it in this way. So it's because I've had this destructive project beforehand on it that I'm then trying to be more constructive in this paper to say what it might be that we can learn from the maxim. What I say we can learn is we can think more clearly about an ideal that in English is often called legality, often called the rule of law. And I'm not sure how much this literature translates across, so forgive me if I dwell too long on it, but it's worth explaining slightly more what people have in mind when they talk about legality or the rule of law in English or in the in Oxford anyway. The canonical modern discussion for this is usually Lon Fuller and his book The Morality of Law, and he gives this parable of a lawmaker, Rex, who fails to make law in 8 different ways. And following out from Fuller's discussion, then everyone has their laundry lists of the things that the lawmaker has to do to make law. So fullers are things like prospectivity. If Rex has a system of laws that are purely retrospective, then fuller's claim, he fails to make law. Similarly, if the laws are unintelligible, if they're incoherent, these sorts of things are thought to prevent him from making law. Now, within the legality literature, or the rule of law literature, then there are sort of dual ambiguities for how people talk about these requirements, the requirements of prospectivity, etc. People sometimes mean to offer these requirements as criteria. And for, I'll come to what for in a second, because that's the second ambiguity. And sometimes they mean them to be desiderata. So by that, the idea is, well, let me give you the second ambiguity. The second ambiguity is sometimes they mean to talk about token laws, and sometimes they mean to talk about legal systems. So if you consider criteria first, sometimes people say, for the existence of a legal system, you need to have sufficient compliance with these requirements, with the idea of prospectivity, etc. And if you don't have that, you don't have a legal system. So this is a criterial claim. The thought there isn't you have a bad legal system, it's you have no legal system at all. Sometimes, though, people say something like, no, conformity with these makes it a better legal system. So a legal system which is mostly retrospective, with too many retrospective laws, or even an individual retrospective law, is a bad one. Now, they're clearly not using this as a criterial claim. If you want to say the legal system is a bad one, you've already presupposed the legal system exists, and you're then predicating something about it. You're saying it's a good one or a bad one. So that's criteria and desiderata used in different ways or with the same ideal. Usually people, or very often people, say the criterial claim about the legal system, you only have a legal system if the laws in general are sufficiently, or there are enough of them that are prospective, etc., to have a system. So this is usually thought to be Fuller's parable, that Rex fails to make law because he doesn't have a legal system. And the desiderata idea, the thing that makes it a better or worse law, is, I gave the game away there, usually used to talk about token laws. And so an individual law, which is retrospective, is seen as a bad thing, but not as threatening the legal system. And so we're able to criticize that law for being retrospective without saying it's not a law, that is, without making a criterial claim, without saying that there's no legal system. But the literature on this is quite confused, and this ideal is used in these different ways such that you get at least four different kind of claims being made about with the ideal of legality, that is. Now, in this paper, I'm not seeking to kind of clean up that debate at all. I'm merely saying, here are different ways in which it's used, and keep them in mind. And hopefully it will become clear as I develop my remarks why I think it's important to draw these distinctions. Some authors have already drawn a link, the link that I'm trying to draw in this paper, between aut implies can and legality. One of the more famous is John Rawls in his discussion of the rule of law, who says that these things are interconnected. I mean, he, oddly enough, if I remember right, he says that you can derive aut implies can from the idea of legality, which is a very odd move, but he's saying that there's clearly a link between them, is the thought. And a number of other people have said that. So I'm pointing that out at the start just to stress that my inquiry here is not entirely idiosyncratic. So I'm not sort of crazy for thinking that there is some relation between these ideas. So if there is some relation between aut implies can and legality, the thought is, well, then what might it be? And in the paper, I offer three possible links as a way of understanding these two different or seemingly distinct ideals or claims. The first is a logical relations. So the idea there would be that one of them might be a premise of the other. So you might think, well, ought implies can is a kind of basic maxim, just a basic claim about oughts, and that you can then, with further premises about the nature of legal oughts, derive something like legality, where there ought implies can is serving as a major premise or minor premise, something like this in your argument for it. Something like that is the claim that I'm interrogating in the first paper. And as I've already said, I don't think it's a good way of going about it for the simple reason that usually the rule of law claims, or the kind of claims people want to make about laws, are not conceptual ones, they're normative ones. And so if you want to make the argument work, you have to have a sort of bridging premise to include a normative premise to say how you get from the conceptual claim to the normative claim. And it swiftly gets quite confusing how the argument's supposed to run. But I'm raising that to put it to one side. We can discuss it in Q&A if people want. I don't think that's the thing people really want to do when they raise ought implies can in this context. The second way they might relate is you might have common normative foundations. So if you think ought implies can is not a basic claim about norms in general, you might think that something else is. So the example I have in the paper is Jeremy Waldron, in one paper, seems to think that something like contractualism, or is supposing something like contractualism about norms, is the right way to go. And out of contractualism, you can derive, in separate spheres, claims about legal norms and claims about moral norms, and both of them seem then to be quite similar with the sorts of claims they can make. About moral norms, he thinks you'll derive ought implies can, the idea being that people would not agree to, or would reasonably reject, norms which were impossible. And a similar thought would go for legal norms. But there, notice then the ought implies can and legality are just downstream a common premise or a common normative foundation. They're not themselves related in the logical way. The third possible relation, which is the one that I pursue in the paper, is the idea that these ideals or ideas are analogically related. And so the Dworkin has a nice phrase in an old paper of his that the rule of law or Fuller's precepts have counterpart canons in morality. So the idea there is that something like the rule of law is the legal counterpart to ought implies can. Ought implies can is the moral counterpart to the rule of law as an ideal for norms. And I think that for a lot of people, this is more what they have in mind. So they don't mean to make their claims about the rule of law depend upon, in the way that the logical claim would require, claims about ought implies can. They don't mean to say that there's merely a common foundation, necessarily. They wouldn't want to have to take a stand on that. They might have different views about how, say, ethics and law relate. What they do mean is that these things are kind of similar. I think that it's rarely more precise than that, the idea. And so this is the analogical idea that I'm trying to pursue in the paper. So if that's correct, or if this is a useful way of thinking about it, then there are two payoffs, I think, to it, or two ways in which this might be valuable. The first is that you're not, or we are not as lawyers, beholden to the truth of ought implies can and all of the debates that people have in that literature. So as people, or if people have studied this, they will know there are some quite there are internecine squabbles within the literature on what exactly ought implies can means, on which kinds of oughts it bites on. So is it about reasons? Is it about oughts? If it's about oughts, how do oughts relate to reasons? If it's about oughts, how does that relate to blame? Is blameworthiness implies can, or as sometimes called the principle of alternative possibilities? Are these the same maxim? Are they logically equivalent? Are they distinct? These debates, if possible, we don't want to have our discussion in law, I think, beholden to. They might be useful for us, but I don't think we want our discussions to depend entirely upon them. And it's useful if the analogical claim is correct, that we don't have to, that we can, although not ignore, as I'll say, the moral literature, we can prescind from it to some extent when we're having our discussions. The second benefit we might get is that we can learn something from these other debates. So the rule of law itself is, although widely studied, not always studied with the precision, I think, that the moral philosophers have brought to bear on Ought Implies Can. And those who've read the paper will know, one of the payoffs I try and claim for this move is that we can look to the structure of thought in the Ought Implies Can world and bring this kind of structure into the legal world and say that we can improve upon our thinking of legality in that way. To motivate the idea that there is, that there are common links to these claims, then I say that in both areas, in both Ought Implies Can and in legality, then people have come up with common arguments for why these maxims are the case or why they exist. And I call these the guidance and the fairness arguments. So the guidance argument is something like, some people think it's just conceptually true of morality that it's able to guide us. And so they think that it's just a fact about reasons, for example, that reasons are given by facts which are in some respect within our epistemic ken, which in some respect we're able to access. And the reason for that, or the explanation, as it were, for that link is that if the facts were not in our epistemic ken, we would not be able to be guided by them, and that then is thought to be problematic, or just a basis of it. Similarly, in the rule of law literature, then people usually think the value of the rule of law is that it ensures laws can guide us. So this is the discussion most commonly associated in my world with Joseph Raz. His discussion of the rule of law has been hugely influential, and the main claim about the rule of law is that it is something that ensures laws are capable of guiding us, because, again, there's a further claim, laws are such that they ought to be capable of guiding. There's then a second kind of claim people make, both about morality and law, that I find harder to pin down, and so which I call rather vaguely in the paper fairness. In morality, some people think that it's important that morality not be unfair. I'm going to try not to caricature this, because as you'll see, I don't go along with this argument, but I think the thought is, if morality were to make certain demands of us, be too demanding, it would be unfair, and it's in the nature of morality that it can't be unfair. And so the idea is something like Ought Implies Can falls out of this. And this is in the literature most commonly associated, I think, with David Kopp. But there are some similar thoughts in some cognate debates in things like the moral luck literature, in things like ethical dilemmas, where some of the motivating force seems to be that it would be really unfair if we could be in ethical dilemmas. And similarly, when people talk about the law, then quite often the kind of arguments people make under the garb of legality or the rule of law are based on this idea that it would be really unfair if the law were to demand impossible things of us. So it's really unfair on the person who has to be reasonable if he or she is just sub-reasonable. It's a mean thing for the law to do. So those are, I think, some reasons to think that there are relations between these maxims, that is, they're used in a similar way to talk about structures of norms. So I should clarify that slightly more. In the rule of law, then people, I think, make similar moves to the moves they make in Ought Implies Can. I said there were these dual ambiguities for Ought Implies Can, criteria desiderata, laws, legal systems, and people make the same kind of claims about the rule of law. So sometimes they see it as a criteria, sometimes it's a desiderata, sometimes of a law, sometimes of a legal system. So I think that combined with the common sort of foundations or common ideas, guidance and fairness, means I think we have some reason to think these things are related. What's the payoff? So the first thing I think is we can think more clearly about legality. So we can start building on the arguments people have made in Ought Implies Can to break down the kind of claims we might make about laws. So for example, I'll just give a couple. We might, in Ought Implies Can, people wonder about whether it's indexed to particular agents or just some agents. For instance, in discussions of reasons, then is the conceptual claim that a fact has to be capable of guiding some agent somewhere? Or is it that it's only a reason for me if the fact is within my epistemic ken? Or is it somewhere in between these two, that a person of reasonable capabilities would be able to access the fact, something like that? And I think we have to have similar discussions about the rule of law, legality, when assessing norms. We need to know, are we considering, say, whether this agent is unable to comply with the legal requirement, or some agent is unable to comply with the legal requirement, or most people are unable to comply with it? And the suggestion in the paper is that, depending on whether we're thinking about guidance or fairness ideas, it will depend. So if we're concerned with whether the law is capable of guiding people, then we'll probably there care mostly about whether it's capable of guiding sufficient numbers. But if we're concerned with whether the law is making unfair demands, people more often, I think, index it to particular agents. So this is just a claim about the structure of people's thought. I think people have different agents in mind, and once you sort of pull apart the maxim, which I think Ought Implies Can helps us to do, then you can reveal this and think more carefully about the sort of claims people are making. So two more virtues. One, I think that it allows us to highlight a peculiar thing in the literature, which is Ought Implies Can is one of the puzzling things about it, it seems to me, is that it seems to make sense as something like a command to a legislator. You know, it's stupid to make a law which is incapable of guiding people, because the whole point of the law is for it to guide people. It's unfair to make a law that demands too much of people. These are demands you can make of a legislator. It's not clear to me you can make that kind of claim about morality. Or one of the puzzling things about Ought Implies Can is it seems to suppose that there is a legislator to which morality is beholden. You might think, and some people do, the morality just isn't like that. There's a more tragic view of it in which we may just be stuck with norms we're incapable of complying with. And there is, in this respect, an odd move often made in the legal literature where people say, well, it might make sense in law to have these strict standards, but that makes no sense as a matter of morality. This is most famously said by Thomas Nagel in his essay on moral luck. But that seems to have it backwards. It seems like, you know, morality may be unfair, because we may be stuck with it, but why should law go along with that? Why should we allow laws to be unfair? Well, then that leads into the third thing we might gain from thinking about it in this way, which is that legality is but one ideal amongst another. So this is a more familiar idea. And we might have to be justifiably unfair at certain times for further goods that the legal system might want to achieve. Now, that sort of compromise argument is very hard to get a grip on if you're thinking about this in terms of Ought Implies Can, because if it's a conceptual claim, then notions of compromise don't enter into it. Whereas once you're in the rule of law, separated from this, then you're able to entertain those sorts of thoughts more coherently. So I don't think I want to say much more, so hopefully throw it open to the floor. The things that trouble me at the moment about this is that my reference to fairness is very vague. In my defense, it's because I'm trying to sort of pin down what people mean by it. But I'm quite troubled that there are a number of different ideas floating under this. So if people agree with me or have thoughts for what else I could do on that, that would be very helpful. And I'm also wondering whether there are other links that I've missed. So the payoff here may not be vast, but a lot of people seem to think that there are these relations. And so I'm wondering again whether I'm being obtuse in missing relations. But I would welcome all thoughts, comments, questions, queries, objections, etc. So thank you.
Thank you very much.